So yes, I'm delighted to actually come to this, attend this third conference on religion, spirituality and health. I was fortunate to come 2 years ago for the second conference, and I'm sure if you don't know Bern, it is a delightful, a beautiful place to come, so I really feel privileged. I would like to thank the organisers as well for inviting me, because it's a fantastic honour to be given a platform to share some of the work that I've been carrying out around religion, belief and social work. I am particularly concentrate on religion, belief and social work rather than spirituality, but I hope that some of the messages and some of the work that I've been doing will be relevant to some of your own disciplines and areas of interest. What I'm going to cover in this presentation, I'm going to consider locality, because I think that is very significant. And obviously, coming from Bradford, and I'll talk a little bit about the profile and the breakdown of people, the people living in that locality, and explain why I think it's relevant. I intend to look at some dilemmas that face not only social workers, but welfare agencies that may have to consider these dilemmas when taking into account relevant equality and human rights legislation. So whether working in England, Great Britain, parts of Europe or other parts of the world, I'm sure there is current relevant legislation that you also have to take into account. I'm then going to explain the principles behind a framework that my colleague Philip Gilligan and I have developed. And it was published in a book, Religion, Belief and Social Work Making a Difference, in 2010. So I'll be using some case studies to illustrate how the principles apply in practice. And then I also want to conclude with looking at some of my ideas, some of the research in progress, and particularly considering some of the barriers and influences relating to concepts like is at or honour that some of you may be familiar with, but actually may preclude people from seeking formal help from welfare agencies. And I think suggests that Western countries, such as ourselves, need to develop more alternative and more culturally appropriate responses to tackle social issues such as child abuse, drug and alcohol-related issues, and domestic violence. This is the top picture. It is Bradford. Has anyone ever been to Bradford? Good, I've got some people in the audience. I'm coming as an ambassador from my city. Unfortunately, it's quite modest, it can't compare with lovely Bern. But we've just had, this is our town city hall, the top picture, and we actually have just had launched a new mirror pool. And I think the council members must have been to Bern to see the fountains in front of Parliament Square, because I think they've tried to take a few ideas. And apparently Bradford, it's supposed to be the biggest and the best pool and fountains now. So I'm sure you'll all book your tickets and perhaps want to visit Bradford to see this. Obviously, I thought it was appropriate to actually have some of our significant places of worship. And unfortunately, the technology has let me down, because I did have some lovely church bells to accompany this, which I think as I was walking around Bern this morning and hearing the church bells, it's so familiar to us as part and parcel of whether you're a Christian or not in certain countries to your association with that and a call to prayer, to prayer worship. But this is our cathedral, which is the oldest sort of church, but drawing back to the 1458. Then we've got an Anglican church, Catholic church. The other building is the Light of the World Gospel Hall Community Church, which has a mainly African Caribbean congregation, became a registered charity in 1985, and a Moravian church established 1938. Some of you are probably aware that obviously Bradford does have a significant and growing Muslim South Asian population. And when people first came as migrants to work in Bradford, I think the intention was that mainly men came to work, and the view was to then improve their economical means and return back to their homeland. What then happened was actually people decided to stay, and particularly of the South Asian population, obviously worship was important. And so we can see at the top right-hand corner, sorry, I've got a prompter there. I think this claims to be the oldest mosque in West Yorkshire. And as you can see, these actually were situated in ordinary residential accommodation. Since then, there's been obviously a schools, cinemas, churches have become vacant. These perhaps have become also become mosques. And obviously, we're showing the wealth of the Muslim population in Bradford. This is a newly purpose-built mosque with a capacity of about 4,000 people, which was opened in sort of the early 2003, I think. And this is another mosque as well. Fortunately, I did have a call to prayer to accompany this, but if you can imagine. So the makeup of Bradford is very much a diverse sort of population where we have got, obviously, mosques at the moment. I think there's 79 mosques in the Bradford district alone. We've also got a strong Sikh faith community. So the first Gurdwara was actually opened in 1972. We've also got a newly built Hindu temple, and that was opened in April 2008. And we do have a Reform synagogue, but fortunately that is fighting survival because our nearest city is Leeds, and I think that's got quite a high Jewish population. But as you can see, then we're very diverse of people representing the major faiths. So I'd just like to say a little bit about Bradford, because obviously I was born, well, I wasn't born there, but brought up there and then lived away and came back. And we've got a population of about 500,000. Some of you might know then it's Bradford's situated in the north of England, and its wealth came from a booming textile industry that attracted waves of people from Ireland, from Eastern Europe, Caribbean and South Asia. And the population in Bradford does continue to grow, unlike perhaps some other metropolitan districts. It's the fourth largest metropolitan district in England, following Birmingham, Leeds, Sheffield. And nearly 23% of the population are under 16. That's compared to 19% regionally and nationally. So quite a young population. There is quite a lot of poverty in Bradford, unemployment, and obviously that does affect some of the youngest people living in that city. Roughly, we've got 49.4% male, 50.6% female, and 18% of the total population, that's of South Asian origin, predominantly from Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, and that was taken from the census 2001. We've just had a new census carried out, which is 2012, and this is a 10-year list survey of the whole population of Great Britain. And this is used by central and local government, health authorities, and other organisations to target their resources and plan services. Although the statistics have not yet been published, it's estimated that the district's ethnic minority population is going to form 26% of the district's total population. So you can see quite a significant and growing number made up of that the group within Bradford. Just although these are data statistics now, and some of you might be familiar with some of these figures, particularly if you're working in England, Great Britain. Just in terms of religion, you can see that those identifying as Christian were 60.1%, followed by Muslims, 16.1%. And those of having no religion or not stated was a combined 21.4%. And just as a point of comparison, you can then see that Bradford has a lower number of those identifying as Christian than across the county of West Yorkshire and England as a whole. but there are more Muslims living in Bradford than across West Yorkshire and England and Wales. And I think it is vital that these type of statistics are considered in order to gain a picture of the local population. For just as a for an example, Hindus, you can see, accounted for 1.06 of the population of the total UK population in 2001, but actually for 15% of the population in Leicester, while 74% of British Hindus live in London and the East and West Midlands. So the census also demonstrates that populations adhering to the larger minority religions are concentrated in particular localities and include then very high proportions of individuals under 25 years and are people who appear to be actively maintaining and interpreting the cultural and religious values of their parents. So it's important to think that place has significance. And just again, as some examples, in Muslim families had the largest number of children, over a quarter, that was 27% of the British Muslim families, had three or more dependent children, compared with 14% of Sikh, 9% of Hindu, and 7% of Christian families. The National Centre for Social Research reports from the findings of the 2006 British Attitudes Social Survey that 31% of people questioned that belonged to a religion, and I suppose this speaks with Harold's earlier statistics from America, or attended religious services, that this group had markedly different attitudes towards things like premarital sex and abortion than people who do not have a religious identity. And the difference between the two groups has actually widened over time. So we can see then that religion does make a difference to people who regularly attend religious service, or in terms of Muslims, it is part of their identity and there is no differentiation. And those people might be less likely to support things such as euthanasia, for example. Therefore, I think it's important that I'd advocate that not only organisations and practitioners, whether from health and social care services, consider the religious makeup of their local communities, but be in a position to assess and to meet the needs of the population in optimal and relevant ways. In terms of, obviously, as a social work educator, I've been teaching or preparing social work students to work as social workers for 18 years, and the last 10 years, which has been at Bradford University. And some of the dilemmas that obviously that our students and practitioners face often on a daily basis are to do perhaps with conflicts. And I think it's interesting that the work that Philip and I have been doing since 2003, it's been clear that students either feel that they get little preparation or struggle to engage. How do you actually deal with some of these dilemmas if it's of your own religious convictions, or to actually appreciate some of the conflicts for the people that they're going to be working with? And Britain, I think like many other countries, is struggling to find perhaps law and policy that balances both democratic and individual rights with the principle of equal advantage for minority communities and faiths. The goal of multiculturalism has come under attack as an ideology that attempts in some guises to promote the rights of all to follow their cultural and religious practices, perhaps regardless of whether these have the potential to conflict with universal human rights. And we have a body called the Equality and Human Rights Commission, and some of you might be aware of some of the high-profile cases that they're considering at the moment, where there have been issues between people of faith and their religious convictions against others, and should it be about competing rights. But the issues that perhaps we sort of try and get students to talk about in terms of the cases that they're dealing with, as well as qualified social workers, where there might be issues maybe obvious issues about termination of pregnancy, abortion, mercy killing, views about euthanasia, contraception, consumption of alcohol, sexual intercourse outside of marriage, same-sex sexual relationships, beliefs in spirit possession, whether for positive and negative effects, and I notice there's some presentations around that here. Use of donor organs, issues of corporal punishment, physical abuse of children. Again, there's been recently in Keighley, which is part of Bradford District, there's been a high-profile case where one of the teachers in a madrasa was seen to be hitting children attending that madrasa, and that then was resulted in a police conviction, and that person's now been imprisoned. But yet there was evidence that had that been accepted as a cultural tradition or norm by some of the local groups. So there are issues, I think, which we've got to engage with, and not to get into othering this, but to think, well, we've got to have some basic understanding about if harm affects people, how can we deal with that? There's issues to do with the authority, rights of children, adults, women and men. So I think all of these, such matters, they raise important questions then regarding the extent to which individual conscientious objection can be accommodated. And I think such issues may also raise significant dilemmas for faith-based organisations where they believe that legislation or government guidance requires them to act in ways which are contrary to their fundamental teachings and against what they see as their duty to their God. And the cases that I mentioned with the Equality and Human Rights Commission, there was one about a couple that were Christian that refused to accommodate a gay couple. And in fact, the ruling was that it was upheld that the gay couple's rights had been discriminated against. And again, that has raised sort of some critics in from Christian churches about that ruling. I think this current one's going through the European Parliament as well to be heard about, and whether that judgment then will affect some of the practices that are being considered in our country. There's also, some of you might be aware, in terms of faith-based organisations, Catholic Care, which is was an organisation that encouraged adoption, was an adoption agency, and obviously they didn't wish to vet or allow people who were gay to become adopters. So that case, it's meant that the Catholic agency has decided not to continue with that particular service. So I think there's emerging issues all of the time which we need to sort of consider. And I think the other side is that with religious believers then usually have an obligation to uphold or follow certain moral laws in accordance with their religious traditions. Therefore, I think it's important that practitioners become aware of members of different religions and are expected to carry out and comply with certain acts, perhaps ranging things from doing things that are obligatory to avoiding others that are categorically forbidden. Humanists may reject the divine basis for morality, but will instead take into account some key principles, such as treat others as you'd like to be treated, and consider the consequences of actions when making moral decisions. Therefore, some of you might have heard of Rima, who is an American social work professor who's developed a framework for dealing with ethical decisions. And he said it's critical that social workers explore clients' perspectives about what they believe is ethically right and wrong and identify the basis of these beliefs in order to locate potential conflicts to others and themselves and to deal with matters of conscience. So this is the framework that Philip and I have developed, and it was actually based on interviews with social workers And in our book, we've actually written up some of the cases, but obviously anonymised those for to protect the identity of the people there. But as you can see, what is centre to all of this is the service user, and whether that's the patient, the resident in the care home, the person using the health and social care service. So very much it's from a strength-based model whereby we should be trying to find out what is important to the person so that we can consider as social workers or other practitioners, what are their needs, views, beliefs and responsibilities. And so the first principle, first principle I'd like to sort of look at this one is the opportunities to discuss religious and spiritual beliefs and the strengths, difficulties and needs which arise from them. So as a social work lecturer, I teach values and ethics to the social work students, and I also teach mental health practitioners who are qualified at post-qualifying level. And part of that is actually teaching them to the user framework and to think about how to engage with such issues about religion and belief. And for many students, it's perhaps the first time they've actually been able to discuss such issues. And I think often it is about giving opportunity, whether in class, just here with fellow colleagues, to discuss some of these. In a recent annual workshop that we covered with students, whereby we set questions so that students could feel, hopefully develop confidence and more ease about discussing and asking each other about their belief systems, whether religious or not. When we asked for feedback about the relevance of the framework and also then asking these questions, one student said, after speaking to another student who they didn't know, they felt quite bereft. And I thought that was interesting because obviously as social work students, you're expected to go in and build up a relationship quite quickly, talk about perhaps intimate details of people's lives. And that can actually then have a massive impact on the person there. And this student was feeling that by exposing her own sort of religious, spiritual beliefs. The next sort of principle is about listening to what people say about their needs and beliefs. And although this seems to be, you know, an important that we do, we should obviously listen. But this was a case from a social worker who worked with older people who were living in the community. And this case concerned Barbara, who was in her 80s, a married woman who was terminally ill. And the social worker had been working with her to sort of make arrangements to support her as best she could. And then as they were finishing the interview, the social worker said, is there anything else that you'd like me to discuss or to cover? And Barbara said, what happens next? So immediately the social worker felt, well, is this a question about end of life? Is it about heaven and hell? How on earth am I going to answer this particular question? And quickly then sort of responded, well, what do you mean? And so Barbara said, well, who's going to look after my cat? So immediately she was relieved, thinking, you know, I'd expected this sort of deep philosophical question, but actually is listening to what people say. And in fact, her husband hated the cat, so she was more concerned with its future welfare once she'd obviously passed on. So that's just a simple sort of explanation of the principle, that it doesn't have to be a sort of serious intent. The next principle is about how we recognise individuals' expertise about their own needs and beliefs. And this was a case reported by a social worker working in a hospice. And the case that she told us about was about Mina, who was a widow and had no children. and she'd had periods of respite care provided by the local hospice, and over that time had built up a good sort of relationship with the staff at the hospice. She was admitted perhaps with only a few days left to live, and although she was not a practicing Hindu, she expressed a wish for staff to actually to read prayers with her when she was dying. The staff in this case were not familiar really with the Hindu faith, and they didn't know a practicing Hindu they could draw upon, but it was just a matter of asking Meena how they could help. And the staff team in this case consisted of a Jewish nursing student, a Jewish consultant, a Christian social worker, and the Baha'i social worker. So as they all gathered round her bed and read prayers so that she was able to die with her friends and hearing the word of God, a lamp was also lit near the bed as a sign that the soul could go to Svarga, a place to rest after death. So in capturing some of these cases, it was quite moving that, you know, people could actually do some quite small steps but actually have a significant impact on people's life at key periods, critical times in their life. The next principle is about creative responses to individual needs and beliefs. And I'm sure that a lot of you are familiar with the impact of managerialism, bureaucratic processes, trying to be more efficient so that time is limited, people have got to meet targets, performance indicators, that what's often been lost is this amount of creativity that people can actually feel that they can actually bring into their work, particularly in health and social care. But I think there is still some autonomy that, and I think we have to hold on to that as professionals working in this field, to think, can we still be creative, or is it just that we're actually following, you know, checklists, tick boxes, and just conforming to perhaps sometimes the bureaucratic regulations. So this particular case, and some of you might be quite surprised at this example that I'm going to give. This was from a social worker that worked with people who were mentally unwell, so mental distress. And this case was about Michael, who was a white British man in his 30s. And what eventually, after the social worker was again able to build some sort of relationship with him, he confided that in fact the basis of, or what he felt the basis of his distress was more to do with that he felt that his motorbike was actually possessed. And when she sort of questioned him about this, it was that friends, he said that friends had used to phone him, and he believed that they used to say to him, if you ride your motorbike today, then bad things are going to happen to you. And so this became part of his ill health. So in this case, the social worker tried to be quite open-minded, although sceptical, and wanted to listen to Michael. But on asking him what he wanted to do, he said he wanted to have his motorbike exercised. And so she actually went with him to the local vicar. Some of you are smiling here. The local vicar, to ask her then if he would carry out this exorcism. And the vicar did agree to exercise the motorbike. And for Michael, he then believed that actually he was free from some of this sort of distress. And I'm sure if you said to many social workers, whether in England or other parts of the world, would you go as far as that? Perhaps people would not even consider that. But is it about being open and listening to what the person believes is the problem? And I know that we have, obviously, psychiatrists among you, and I don't, obviously, I'm not an expert in mental health, but, you know, I'm sure you've come across cases before where people have sort of strong either religious beliefs which might impact on their well-being. So the next principle is about seeking out relevant information and advice regarding unfamiliar religious and spiritual beliefs and practices. So that sounds pretty straightforward, doesn't it? That, you know, with the use of the internet now, you can actually research about the traditions of different faiths. And again, a lot of our students say, how can I possibly know everything about different religions, different cultures, which is impossible. But if you're working in an area like Bradford, it's obviously going to be significant that you can draw on resources from local imams in mosques and other religious leaders if you feel that's going to be relevant to a case that you're working. And in this particular case that was given to us, Omar is 32 years old and is married with 4 children. He's had a number of jobs and, as a practicing Muslim, attends Friday prayers each week. About 2 years ago, the family started to become worried as he slept with a knife under the pillow. He described seeing visions, the prophet on a white horse, and to hear angels who instructed him to crash his car. At around the same time, his cousin, who was a Sufi, had spoken to Omar about his beliefs, and Omar had become a Sufi. The social worker encouraged Omar to speak to his Sufi leader and to find out whether he was describing what was considered normal in a spiritual sense or whether he shared any worries about Omar's behaviour. It became clear that his behaviour was viewed as unusual, and his sheikh agreed to help by talking to Omar about his visions so that the social worker could concentrate on Omar's recovery, his interactions with his children, and his role in the household. Omar's wife was doing all the household chores, and with help from Omar's father, he used to take the children to school in the morning. So Omar's day revolved around prayer, reading the scriptures, but the social worker encouraged him to speak to his sheikh about his role in the family, as the sheikh was also married with children. The family and the sheikh also encouraged Omar to take his medication. And although the medication did alleviate Omar's symptoms, however, he missed his spiritual experiences and kept stopping his medication to recreate the visions. So, you know, a good example that you can work with faith-based organisations. And I know, again, Harold was saying about that spiritual assessment. I don't think we've got as far as social workers actually on discharge from hospital asking social workers to do that. But I think it is important perhaps to have allegiances and contacts of people in the local community to work together, particularly where there might be some mental ill health, whereby it can be very supportive for the person affected by that. And I'm sure that we'd all recognise that in terms of professional practices, we should have relationships which are characterised by a genuine interest and concern, trust, respect, and a willingness to engage with others. Because that's the starting point. If we haven't got that interest in the people that we're working with, people are not going to confide in you these aspects of the life, which might be seen as private, too personal, too embarrassing to discuss. And we also need, I think, to be self-aware ourselves and reflexive. We have to think about, what is our own sort of religious and spiritual beliefs, and what are our responses to beliefs of others? Again, working with students who, I'm sure some of you might be familiar with this term being non-judgmental, which I'd say that social workers certainly aren't, you know, they are judgmental. But what it is trying to be open to others' beliefs. And again, students where we've done this work with say that they felt they were being open, but actually appreciated after sort of thinking about some of these questions and the exercises that were actually, they were, because they didn't appreciate the impact and significance of the person's religious beliefs, then they didn't investigate and allow discussion about that. I think that was, again, a point covered earlier, that I think it is a lost opportunity, and it's ourselves that actually create the space to engage with people around these issues. So the research that we've conducted since 2003, and there was similar research conducted in America by Furman and Kander, looking at actually sort of the training of social workers. And sort of then it was felt that although people are being brought up with religious or spiritual beliefs, and that many continue to hold these, that generally practitioners did receive very little and inconsistent preparation about how to respond to the needs of individuals and groups for whom religion or spiritual beliefs are of central importance. And the last sort of principle here is about, are we open then and willing to respond, review and revise? And I think this is a lot of the principles that I've discussed are captured in the next case study. And this was a student social worker who's white British, white English social worker. And we collected these cases as part of a study to find out the usefulness of our framework when people were on placement, that is, working with service users as part of their training. And we've had this published in the British Journal of Social Work in 2010. In this case, the student was actually worked with a British-born Muslim Pakistani woman who was in her early 20s, who had been raped by an ex-boyfriend. He'd held her captive, cut her hair, hands and arms, destroyed pieces of her property, and although she reported this attack to the police, she heard nothing further after 15 days. Reflecting on the event, the student noted, "On my first meeting, my lack of beliefs informed the fact that I didn't think to take her religion and culture into account. After speaking to her, I became aware of the significance of her family's beliefs, their impact on her dealing or not dealing with the attack." So the student, I think, recognised that she knew very little about the Muslim faith and was able to learn from the woman why she was not able to tell her family about the attack, as she wished to spare their shame, or sharam, over her own. The woman also believed that the police were not dealing with the issue because of her religion or ethnicity. The student was open to revising her assumptions about Islam and to appreciating that individuals express their beliefs in different ways. She listened to the woman and helped her to work out a creative plan that would assist her to get support from her family. This entailed telling the family that she had been mugged rather than raped, while the worker assumed the role of a friend while visiting the home. In this way, the woman was able to maintain her family's respect, and she avoided bringing shame to them, but was able to grieve openly with support from them. So I think many of the principles I've covered, say, have been captured in that case study in quite sort of powerful in terms of then how the student was able to work and engage with that young woman in a quite a positive way. For the final part of the presentation then, I'd just like to move on to look at this notion of izzat or honour, and particularly perhaps for you where this concept is less familiar. So I would argue that as service providers and practitioners, we need to actually develop perhaps greater cultural competence. I don't know if there's just a show of hands, how many people have heard of this term, cultural competence? Few people. Has anyone seen Howell's model before? Yeah, some again. There are critics of the term cultural competence, but I think what is useful is about, it's a term that can capture how do we actually engage and recognise diversity? So diversity shouldn't just be about ethnicity. It's about gender, it's about age, it's about our sexual orientation, about disability. And how do we actually, encourage practitioners to be more mindful of this term? And I think it's important because when you think about possible barriers that affect the take-up of health and social care services, and looking at these concepts of shame, embarrassment, sharam, honour, respect, izzat, and guilt. And it's difficult if we're not fully aware of what these concepts are. So the starting point, I think it's useful to think about Howell's model. How do we know what we don't know, this unconscious incompetence? So I like this model that if you consider it in terms of learning to drive, when you first get behind a car, you're hopeless, you've no idea how to actually start the car, how to drive. And once you've actually had some practice, you realise you quickly become consciously incompetent, that you make mistakes, you can't do a three-point turn, you can't actually back into that parking space. And when we're preparing then for our test, we become more consciously competent so we can prove that we actually are roadworthy. And if you know that there's quite a number of models, which they did originate in America, particularly for nursing students, and we've tried to borrow that now in England to think about maybe some of the models which could be useful in trying to recognise why is it that some of our services are not culturally appropriate for the population that it serves. So this model, I think the last stage that Howell talks about is about unconscious competence, which personally I don't think is useful, because I think once if we fall back into bad habits, then we can easily go back into the unconscious incompetence mode. But I think there's some scope in thinking about some of these next issues I'm going to talk about. So some of you have the work that I'm trying to do at the moment, sort of reviewing the literature and looking at Ruth Benedict's work, some of you might be familiar with, who's an American anthropologist. And this is going back to 1967, proposed then that there are these guilt and shame cultures. And I think it's important to recognise that no one culture just operates solely on one system or the other. But I think it's certainly worth revisiting this, that it's perhaps useful to remind ourselves that different cultures do operate on predominantly different value systems, and that there are pressures to conform to religious and cultural norms and expectations. In the Western world, I suppose we tend to measure our actions and behaviours against what we consider perhaps to be right and wrong. If we commit a criminal act, then we may be found to be guilty or innocent by a court of law. So guilt then is this internal mechanism that alerts the individual by an internalised sense of right and wrong to control his or her behaviour. Some of the major faiths, I'm sure you're familiar, may be governed by guilt principles. So when we do something wrong, either go against a religious doctrine, for example, having sex outside of marriage or not using a contraception, if Catholic, then we may feel this fading sense of guilt. We can even feel a sense of guilt when we haven't done anything wrong. I don't know if any of you have recently been called in to see your manager at work, and I know I often feel, have I done something wrong, rather than thinking, what have I done right that they want to praise me about? So it can be part of our unconscious psyche that we've got this sort of right and wrong sort of behaviour. But some believe that thinking in terms of right and wrong perhaps is the only acceptable way of behaving, but other cultures may practice honour and shame as the dominant norms. So perhaps in some Arab countries, Muslim countries, it is not about acting right or wrong, but acting in an honourable or a dishonourable way. So members of a culture brought up to respect izzat, or the honour of the family, above all else, represent their families at all times. So if they act shamefully, then the family or tribe will react against them. Shameful deeds are covered up. If they can't be covered up, they are revenged. And so I think it's important that not to sort of stereotype and make assumptions that you'll have that generalised through all, but I think there's still some scope to consider that in the people that we may come across in our services. So in terms of England, people often from black and ethnic minorities are still underrepresented in terms of take-up of certain services. And there have been, over the years, a range of strategies which have been put in place to try and find out why that is so. Is it about because English isn't the first language? Is it about we haven't got enough literature that actually informs people about the services that are there? And I think it's still been very difficult to know why there is this underrepresentation. But I think what we have to do is perhaps to think, are we then developing more culturally appropriate responses? So I had a recent meeting with the manager of our NSPCC, which is obviously a national child protection organisation in England. And what they've been doing in Bradford, when they found there's been a very low referral rate particularly from South Asian families, of child abuse referrals, they thought, well, why is that? This isn't a normal pattern. You know, we're getting, why is it just seems to be in white British families? So what they did was they took their service out to women living in the local community, and first of all, through getting to know people, through drinks, food, then built up that trust so that people actually felt more able to discuss some of their problems, some of their issues with them. I think, unfortunately, in this sort of era of cutbacks that we're facing, then there'll be less creative responses, but I think that is the need we need to go, rather than actually expecting people to fit into the sort of standard services that we tend to offer. Lynn Key, I met this year at a conference in Chester, and as part of her PhD, she's written a book about indigenising social work in Sarawak. And in that book, I read about her sort of model taken from her research in Sarawak about help-seeking behaviours. And I felt it was quite relevant to this talk. And although I'm sure all of us, if we've got a problem, we perhaps would think, is there a close family member that we could go to? But I think it's important to look at the emerging literature that's coming out of, you know, a number of countries now about different ways of understanding help-seeking behaviours. And what she talked about was that in Sarawak, which is part of Indonesia, where it's sort of Chinese Malay people, that very much that family members were the first port of call. And then if the family weren't able to help or resolve the problem, then it was to try and find, was there a trusted other? And again, that can be difficult. If you don't know a social worker, you don't know the doctor, you know, you might have an issue with drug misuse. Who do you go to if the family are trying to save face and protect the wider community knowing about this particular problem? So I think that goes back to the NSPC example, where if you can find some way of trust, then people may be more prepared to disclose the issue. And then moving on to a bit more dangerous territory, that the family maybe wished to deny or suppress the problem. Or if the family thought the problem was under control, they might not wish to tell the truth about it, and it may be better to lie and face the consequences of dishonouring the family. And the final position, the family is the problem. And again, in Bradford, we have a number of cases amongst local community, our students who face things like forced marriage. We've had a recent case of a student in my social work division who had to be rescued from a family by the police. She was being physically and sexually abused by her family members. she was able to tell a tutor at the university, but that's meant that she's had to forge a new life, you know, to be removed from her family, and if they find her, then she's likely to be killed. So we are dealing with some, you know, very difficult issues here about how to actually gain access to some families. And I must say that other issues can happen, obviously, in white British families as well. But I suppose just to finally sort of conclude, we are living in a global world. The makeup of our population is changing, whether for economic or humanitarian reasons. But I think as researchers, we are really well placed to actually consider and investigate the impact of cultural and religious beliefs on those using health and social care services, and how their diagnosis, treatment and care can be made much more effective by trying to appreciate and understand how internalised, perhaps moral codes and norms affect their judgments in relation to seeking help or disclosing their situations. In the UK, we've had successive attempts to identify perhaps shared values that can be owned by British citizens. I think most people, at the heart of this is about respect. Most people want to be respected, and I think we have to think, how can we actually engender that between our different communities and this acceptance of each other? And I think this does need perhaps further research to find out really what people understand by this and why individuals, groups and communities fail to respect and honour, particularly females in the families. I did have then some music, which unfortunately, it's let me down, but this is the celebration of our mirror pool, where you can see obviously a cross-section of the community, and it was going to be played to Aretha Franklin's Respect, so if any of you know that, that's what you should be hearing now. And so what it was a day to actually bring people together. Bradford does have problems, and we are working hard to try and think about segregation, how communities can live together and understand each other better. And if you haven't seen our book, obviously I would urge you to buy it, and also I'd highly recommend it. So there's no bias there. Okay, so thank you for listening anyway.